This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents Dispossession. Written by Tayari Jones. Performed by Gabrielle Union.
Boys can break your heart worse than men. I say this as someone who's been both a wife and a mother. When you stand up in front of the preacher with your husband, you pray that it will be forever, but you know that just a good long run will put you ahead of the pack. And a nice streak of happy, even if it ends up going to hell, that's a bonus round. But after you birth a son, you pray different. And when you raise a black son, you pray like you've never prayed before. I'm not telling the truth if I don't mention the black part. My son says that I spend too much time thinking about black this and black that. It's tiresome. When Javonte talks like a person from a book, I never know quite how to respond. I'm decent with words, but I can't compete with him. As I struggle to find the best comeback, he changes his voice and I can hear the Georgia sweetness in his accent again. Mama, he says, I'm just trying to be happy. I know, I say back, because now we're talking the same language. And I want you to be happy. Never has my mouth spoken truer words. From the second he was born, maybe even before then, maybe from the moment me and his daddy made him, I knew my real purpose. I know most people shoot to give their kids a better life than they had, but me, I am more ambitious than that. When I was in high school, there was a big sign in the cafeteria that said, "Low aim is sin." Let's just say, I took it to heart. Javonte is an only child, but me and my sister Shelby were pregnant at the same time. I was 25, lawfully wedded and proud of it. Shelby was just 16, and while she wasn't proud, she wasn't hanging her head either. Our boys arrived 3 months apart, hers first. It was nice for Javonte and Mauricio to grow up together. You should see the pictures, cute as can be. Shelby went on to have 3 more kids and 2 husbands, but me, I was one and done on both fronts. There's only so many people you can give a better life to. A positive childhood costs money, a happy marriage too. For years, I worked in a perfume shop in the West End, mixing knockoffs of popular fragrances. There was talk of me becoming a regional manager. My husband worked as an exterminator. We were comfortable, but there wasn't much extra. It was nobody's fault, but summer of 2006 was a rough season. Shelby was just 29, but she came down with cancer. It was the treatable kind, praise him. But the regimen wasn't easy. I took Mauricio in to live with me and my family. The girls went to stay with various relatives on their daddy's sides. I'm not making excuses, but I was working a lot more than I usually did. My husband picked up extra shifts, too. Shelby's tumors weren't going to shrink themselves, and oncologists like to be paid. Landlords and banks, too. Also, 13-year-old boys eat a lot. That's why the boys were unsupervised. I will own it, like Javonte likes to say. When he says he owns something, it's his way of apologizing. But I don't apologize for leaving the boys all alone on those summer days. I really didn't have a choice. But I am sorry for it. When I was coming up, they used to call it juvenile hall. Now they call it a youth detention center. That's where I went to collect Javonte and Mauricio on a Wednesday afternoon in July. The police hadn't caught them doing anything, exactly. Javonte and Mauricio were sprinting down Stewart Avenue, flying on foot, bare-chested and fast. Their speed and grace caught the attention of a couple of officers on patrol who took off after them. This wasn't the stop and frisk that you hear so much about these days. This was chase and tackle. The boys swore up and down that they were just racing. Just playing. Just being kids. When I finally saw them, Mauricio's cheek was scarred with a pavement burn and Javonte's glasses were held together with masking tape. My boy was sobbing and sucking snot, but Mauricio was quiet and still but for his leg, which bounced like a sewing machine. Running is not a crime, the child advocate said. She did mention that the boys had about $200 in cash between them. Luckily, the advocate said, having money isn't a crime either, but mother to mother? She told me to find out where that money came from. There was a lot of blame to go around, and we spread it like honey on a biscuit. My husband blamed Mauricio because Javante had never been in trouble before this. Mauricio blamed his mama for being sick in the first place. I pointed my finger at the police for slamming children on the concrete. When they wrenched my baby's arm back, he didn't even have hair growing underneath it. Javante put all his blame on me. Not for what happened then, but for what happened next. I let his daddy beat him. My husband came after those kids with a leather strap. He gave them a couple of good licks and asked them where they got the wad of 20s that the police fished from their pockets. Mauricio pressed himself in the corner and didn't say a word, but Javante must have thought the truth was going to set him free because he explained that they had taken the money in exchange for running down the street when they saw cops coming. That's all, Daddy, he said. Like, that was all. My ex-husband is mostly a gentleman. You trying to tell me? He said, swinging the belt in furious arcs. You trying to tell me that I've been out all day spraying roaches looking for mouse turds and breathing poison for this? I do this shit every day trying to make it where you can be somebody and you doing this bullshit? He beat our son and then pulled Mauricio from the corner and whipped him too. When you go to jail, don't think I'm putting this house up to pay bond. We've done too much for you little jokers already. I let him beat them until he was tired of beating them. He beat them until they were tired of crying. He beat them until it wouldn't do any good to beat them anymore. When it was all done and the boys went to tend to each other, I walked to the kitchen to fix my husband a plate. Before he ate, he took my hand and we prayed. I kept counsel in my head, but my husband spoke aloud. Don't let nobody take him from us, Lord. So when the recruiter from the Clearwater School came sniffing around, looking for underprivileged kids to rescue, we were primed. When the white man offered up the slick brochure and promised financial aid, how could we look at it as anything other than one of the complicated ways that God has answered prayers? Nobody would take our son from us if only we gave him away. That was more than a decade ago. Now Javante lives in Vermont and works for that ice cream company that's trying to change the world. I had no idea there was so much that went into ice cream or that someone could get so much satisfaction from it. The thing about the next generation is that they know things that we don't. Or, let me put it this way, if you are a good parent, your kids will open up the field and do things you never even thought about. This is what I keep telling myself. I've only seen him twice since he got married 4 years ago. He said that the ice cream company was keeping him tied up. I pretended to believe him. What would be the point of forcing him to speak the real reason he didn't want to come back to the old neighborhood? I don't beg him or make him feel guilty. I just let him know the door is always open, that the key he has hung on his ring since he was a little boy would always fit the lock. 2 weeks ago, he told me he was coming home for the long MLK weekend. I called my job and pleaded for the days off, even though I needed the hours. But on Wednesday, he called and said he couldn't make it. Ice cream never sleeps, he said with a little apologetic laugh. Because bills don't sleep either, I called my job and pleaded for my hours back. They had given my shifts away, but there was a little gig that needed doing, and I snatched it up. The company I work for is called Overeducated Movers, which is a joke because we are not exactly a bookish workforce. The only one overeducated is the big boss, who got a doctorate degree in Elizabethan poetry before discovering that there weren't any kind of jobs out there in Elizabethan poetry. I know this because he explains this to everybody when he first hires you. Then he smiles, showing off his real pretty teeth, and explains that he started helping people pack and move, and now, then he waves his hands, showing off his pretty fingernails, he owns all this. I pretended to be impressed because I needed the job. I didn't have a degree in Elizabethan poetry, but I did fall for the okey-doke and took one of those courses you see advertised on the MARTA bus. They said they would train me for a career in health services, and I could be a phlebotomist in less than a year. I was imagining myself suited up in purple scrubs, maybe with a stethoscope around my neck, telling people this wouldn't hurt a bit. On the 1st and the 15th, I would get my check by direct deposit. I did my part. I paid for the classes and did pretty good when you take into account that I graduated high school in 1987. I was a pretty sharp student back in the day, but that was 30-some years ago. To get through the program, I had to study and study hard. I was honored to finish in the top 5% of the class. For the graduation ceremony, the women wore white dresses like we were on the usher board. The men wore dark pants and white shirts. My whole family was there. My sister, Shelby, brought her girls, her man, and her son, Mauricio. My ex was in attendance, and thank God he didn't bring his wife. I suspect he showed up just to catch a glimpse of his firstborn. Still, he didn't come with his arms swinging. He handed me a small box wrapped in glitter paper. Inside was a necklace with a little graduation hat dangling from the chain. Javonte had flown in that morning and flew out that night. His wife wasn't the only white person in the room, but she stood out. Vermont white folks are different from Georgia white folks. Don't ask me what it is. It could have just been her dress, cut from a fabric that looked coarse, but when you touched it, it was soft as a cloud. She took it in stride, saying that this was a good experience for her to try and understand what Javonte goes through up there where they live. But she didn't call him Javonte. She calls him David, his middle name. That's what he goes by up there. And I did my best to remember when I was introducing him to people. On top of my chest of drawers is a nice picture of us taken that day. I'm holding a bright bouquet so big that you can hardly see my face. My son is turned my way, smiling like he loves me. On the back he wrote, "Congratulations, Mama. I am proud of you." I wanted to put it in the frame backwards just to see those words. I miss that boy, Javonte. I admire David and all his ice cream science, but Javonte is my whole heart. A year after the graduation, I figured out that the whole thing was a scam because no hospital, doctor's office, or clinic cared one bucket of spit about my certificate with the raised lettering and gold seal. So, this is how I ended up as an undereducated person working for overeducated movers. Mauricio's the one who hooked me up with this company. I ran into him in Kroger off Cascade Road. He's a grown man now, nearly 30. But up under the beard, I still see the boy who used to keep my house full of mischief and laughter. "Aunt Cheryl," he said, throwing open his arms and pulling me in for a hug. Mauricio was the picture of his mother and my mother, too. The same long, lean build and squared-off jaw. I am round and low to the ground like my father. We chatted and caught up, but I could feel him looking at my cart. Maybe his mother had briefed him on my situation, but things weren't bad enough to justify the worry on his sweet face. I had enough cash to handle my basic needs, but this wasn't the time to buy boutique ice cream from Vermont. "I'm on my way to the butcher counter next," I said so he wouldn't think I was over here living on beans and rice. We talked about Shelby and her progress on wrangling her man down the aisle. We talked about how much we both hated the president. And then he said, "You still got the same number?" I laughed and said, "Yes, that I am the last one in America who still has a landline. Come over sometime and let me cook for you. I bet you haven't had oxtail since Shelby moved to Birmingham." He chuckled. "I had me some home-cooked dinner just last night." I put my hand on my hip. "Mauricio Simmons, what are you trying to tell your auntie?" "I got a lady," he said, whipping out his phone to show me a photo of a young woman I thought I recognized. Her face was plain, but pretty somehow. "I met her at your graduation thing. I'm glad my mama made me put on a tie. Her name is Danielle." "Well, then you and Danielle should come by together for dinner. I'm sure she can cook, but young girls can't cook like mamas can cook. That's just gospel truth." "She does pretty good, but I'm picking up what you're putting down, auntie." Mauricio turned down the volume on his smile. "I'm sorry about how things worked out with your degree and everything." 2 days later, that dear boy called to check on me and mentioned so casually that the place where he worked was hiring, that they paid almost twice the minimum. Just as casual, I asked for the number, telling him that I was thinking about leaving my job like I had one. Just as easy, he told me that he would put in a word for me. Bless his sweetheart. My job title was packer. I had no idea that rich people didn't have to box up their own stuff when they moved. I suppose that if I had thought about it for a minute, I would have figured as much. Rich people don't do anything for themselves. But who sits around thinking about how rich people relocate? Well, I do now, because it's my job. We get to their houses, and me and the other girls split up the work, and we wrap everything in bubble wrap, box it, tape it, label it, and keep it moving. After we do our thing, the fellas get it out. This job I had today was just a tiny gig, barely worth the trouble. I was the only packer on the schedule. Usually I work with two other girls at least. For the real big houses, monster mansions out in Johns Creek, there might be a half dozen of us sent over there with our tape guns, dish packs, corner protectors, and everything else you need to make sure expensive things get from A to B in pristine condition. When I got to overeducated, Mauricio was waiting for me, along with Big Pete, who has been working this job for 17 years. I climbed in the truck sitting between them. It was all good now. They smelled like washing powder and toothpaste. But by the end of the job, it wasn't going to be cute. I could tell you that much for free. Mauricio balanced a tray with three coffees on his lap and a paper box of donuts. He handed me one of the coffees. It was just how I like it, milky and sweet. I was surprised to see you on the schedule this morning, Mauricio said, with Javante being in town. That's your cousin? Big P said. That's the main thing I miss about being grown, not really having cousins. Y'all close? That's real nice. Me and him are straight, Mauricio said. Like you said, it's different when you grow up. Javante had to cancel, I said, ready to put the conversation down. Ice cream never sleeps. Huh, Big Pete grunted. That ain't what Dr. King died for. They got black people churning ice cream on MLK Day? That's a damn shame. Well, we are moving people's stuff on the same day, I said, feeling defensive on behalf of my son, his job, his everything. Entirely different calculus, Big Pete said. Shut up, Pete, Mauricio said. You always bring up different calculuses when you don't know what you're talking about. Big Pete reached his chunky hand in the box and pulled out a blueberry donut. It's a rhetorical device, he winked. Ain't nothing worse than a Negro with a dictionary, Mauricio said, shaking the donut box at me. I took a cruller. Touche, said Big Pete as he started the truck with a lurch and a burp. One of the things I like about this job is that I get to see parts of the city that before I only knew about from traffic reports. Last week we did a job way up in Gwinnett County and it looked a lot like Vermont, clean and grassy. I made a point to mention it to Javante, but he didn't take the bait. Where is the job? I asked Big Pete. He recited the address precisely like he was saying his Easter speech. You should have told us, Mauricio said. Why did we leave our cars way out in Smyrna if the job was on the southwest side? You know the rules, Big Pete said. No personal vehicles. Mauricio smirked. Ain't like this is a regular job. Who would complain? Me and Auntie Cheryl live right around the corner from there. I perked up a bit at the conversation. I am a bright-sided sort of person for the most part. A family from our neighborhood was getting a white glove move. I felt that little zing of pride you get when you see somebody black break some kind of mold. It wasn't a full-on Obama, but it lifted my spirits. And it made sense that they only needed one packer. It was probably a young person, just out of college on his way to take a big-time job in New York or Los Angeles. You ever did a job like this one before? Mauricio asked me. I reminded him I had been working at Overeducated for 6 months now. What I didn't tell him was that I had been put on notice. The truth of the matter is that I'm not great at this kind of work. The two girls I usually work with, they can pack up a whole house like a couple of machines. They don't inspect the stuff, don't turn it over to see what it looks like on the other side. They just get the items safely wrapped and tucked in the right size box. They do it the whole time talking Spanish to each other. Sometimes they try and speak English so I don't feel left out, but when the gossip gets good, it's Espanol again. I don't blame them. It's hard to communicate in a different language when you get excited. When I am with Javante and his wife, I try to talk proper, saying each letter of every word and every word of every sentence. But eventually, I either get tired or comfortable, and I hear myself talking like my mama running her mouth over the back fence. When I work, I try to be like the girls, with my hands busy but my mind somewhere else. But I can't help it. I am a fundamentally curious person. Mama said I have been nosy all my life. She said when I was born, I stopped crying because I was trying to eavesdrop on the doctor talking to the nurse. Every house we enter is a whole soap opera, and I can't help trying to piece together the details. It's the china cabinets that get me. Everything in there is a story. So did you do one of these before? Mauricio asked again. I hate this shit. Big Pete reached for his coffee and said, somebody got to do it. If it wasn't us, it would be somebody else. Big Pete reminded me of Javante's daddy, a do-what-you-gotta-do kind of person. There wasn't bad blood between me and my ex, it's just that there wasn't much between us one way or the other. When we signed the paper sending our son to boarding school, we were 15 years into a complicated marriage. The day we handed Javante over to Clearwater School, we might as well have signed our divorce papers at the same time. We were not suited to live in a house with just the two of us. We'd been split up for more than 9.5 years when we went to Vermont for Javante's wedding, our last hurrah. As we prepared to walk into the white church that looked like a scene for a Christmas card, he looked at me and picked the same old fight. Why did you send him to that school? We made the decision together, I said. We made a lot of bad decisions together. He lifted his hand like he was about to count them off on his fingers, but the organ started, and we were led down the aisle where we sat on the near-empty groom side of the church. In the truck, Mauricio downed one of the donuts in 3 big bites. When he talked, powdered sugar escaped from between his lips. He was so much like Javante that I wanted to use my wet thumb to clean his face. Remember that one lady that came at me swinging that little fireplace shovel? That was some crazy shit. Big Pete laughed. And she didn't even have a fireplace. Don't worry, partner. I won't let you get killed by Grandma Moses. That shit wasn't funny, Mauricio said. I'm itching just remembering it. That was almost 2 years ago, Big Pete said, reaching in the box for another donut. I can't believe you still getting all PTSD over it. Mauricio put a real calm look over his face, like he was trying to prove he didn't have PTSD or whatever. Pointing over his shoulder, he said, Auntie Cheryl lives right down that street. Big Pete said, there's nothing wrong with keeping it real. We drove another 5 or 6 minutes and made a few left turns before we pulled up to a blue house with white trim. The yard was a bit unkempt. Red clay was broken up with clots of brown grass, but the house itself was in decent shape. Spying the rusty swing set in the side yard, Mauricio sighed, why they always have to have kids? Big Pete said to Mauricio, you ready? Mauricio said, I truly hate this shit. Big Pete said, don't be so scary. The boss said the sheriff locked the door way back on Friday. The word sheriff explained to me what should have been obvious. I'm a smart person, but I can be slow sometimes. We fixing to put somebody out? Mauricio sighed. Big Pete laughed. I got real quiet. Although it's not exactly something that I put on my resume, I know a thing or two about being evicted. Truth be told, I know a thing or two, 3 or 4. And I learned it all before I was 16 years old. I grew up here in Atlanta, on the southwest side of town, but saying that doesn't mean anything. I look at TV and I see all these celebrities talking about how they grew up in SWATs, meaning southwest Atlanta. When I was growing up, that just meant you were black. When I was little, my mama cleaned houses for other black people who had SW in their address just like we did. The difference was that they had a separate bathroom for everybody who lived there, and me and my sister and my mama had to take turns getting to the sink to brush our teeth. We lived off MLK back when it was Hunter Street. We also lived up behind John A. White Park. For a full 2 years, we lived in a yellow frame house in the West End. It was my favorite because there was a big swing on the porch. We didn't get put out everywhere we lived. Sometimes we left of our own accord, but more than once and more than twice, I came home from school and found everything we owned strewn all over the front yard. The last time was in 1987. I remember the year because it was just a month or so before I was supposed to graduate from Mays High School. I told my son that I'm so old that I went to that school back when Dr. Benjamin Elijah Mays was still alive. True story. They used to roll him in his wheelchair, and he nodded his head just a little bit while we sang the school song. Benjamin Mays, providing hope for those who dare. He was in his 90s, and I think maybe he had suffered a stroke or something, but he always seemed pleased. And my mother was pleased that she had gotten me into that good school, even though I wasn't in the academy part. I used to have a picture of myself wearing that powder blue satin jacket like I invented school pride, even as I boarded the bus to ride all the way back to my neighborhood while the other kids hopped in their convertible Rabbits and Volkswagen Jettas. Our landlord didn't hire a moving company to put us out. He did it himself along with his son and one other random person. My mama used to say, "The only thing worse than colored insurance agents is a rent property Negro." She had a lot of things she used to say. She's been gone a good 25 years, but there are some days when I just want my mama. It was a complicated situation. Mama didn't think he would put us out because she had been keeping company with him on the side for a few months. She used language like that, like it was 1950. He came around on the first of the month, sometimes the third, to collect the rent. My mama was a pretty woman, and I'm not just saying that because she was my mother and everyone thinks their mother is beautiful. She had been Miss Washington High in 1967, the first to wear an afro. By 1987, she wore it relaxed and curled like Coretta Scott King. The landlord always called me young lady, and I called him sir. When I came home from school that day, he and his son were carrying my mother's box spring out the front door. The landlord was breathing hard and sweating. He wasn't young, and he wasn't skinny. Setting the box spring down on the patchy grass of the lawn, he said, "How you, young lady?" "Where is my mama?" I asked him. "She went to the store," he said, using the tail of his shirt to mop his face. His stomach was covered with dense hair, and I felt so sorry for my mother. "That's how you gonna do us?" I asked. "It's not personal," he said. "Rent has to be paid. I have been more than patient." I turned my attention to his son, a man probably about 20. He would have been handsome except for his eyebrows, which were so thick that they seemed to be joining with his hairline. His arms were also covered with fur, and I imagined that under his shirt was a pelt to match his daddy's. His neck was marked with a big purple hickey. I was a little bit crazy when I was young. Not set your house on fire crazy, but I wasn't afraid to speak my mind. I waited until they had come back out with Mama's mattress. I was glad she wasn't there because she would have been embarrassed for everyone to see how worn and stained it was. By everyone, I mean the neighbors, who were standing on their porches and lawns gawking like they had never seen anybody get put out before, like they themselves had never been evicted. When father and son carried the mattress, I said, "I bet you're gonna miss that bed, Mr. More Than Patient." Harry Jr. looked confused. It's not every day you see a black man physically blush so hard that you can see it through his brown complexion, but he blushed as hard as that hickey on his neck. "Go run tell your mama that," I said to him. Harry Sr. said, "There's no reason to get ugly. I'm a businessman. This ain't personal. It's business." "How can you say that while you are putting my mother's bed outside in the dirt?" Harry Sr. shrugged and said, "That was just business too." Harry Jr. smirked. "Like I said, I was a firecracker when I was young." I tucked my head and ran at Harry Jr., aiming the top of my head at the soft place just under his breastbone. He dropped his side of the mattress with a sound like oof, and when he fell onto it, I was right on top of him. I punched at him so bad that I hurt my hands. I didn't get more than two or three good licks in before Harry Sr. pulled me off his kid, the way you might pluck a tick off a dog. He gripped me tight and just snatched. As he lifted me off, I aimed a last good kick. "What the hell is wrong with you?" Harry Sr. asked. He paused like he really wanted to know. And when I didn't answer, he slapped me. Then he turned his back like he knew I wasn't going to do anything else. I don't know how he knew it, but he was right. He and his son finished emptying out our house, filling up sturdy boxes they collected from behind the liquor store. When they set some of the boxes down, I could hear broken glass jangling inside. I don't know how long they had been working before I got there, but it took them just over an hour to finish the job, As they were leaving, Harry Sr. tipped his hat. I'm sorry that it ended like this. The tip of his hat made me look over my shoulder, and there was my mother with my little sister. At 7, Shelby had the big teeth all kids have at that age. My mother held her hard by her skinny arm. Fuck you, my mother said to the Harry Sr. When he was gone in his blue Oldsmobile, Mama said, did you really try to fight him? I didn't just try. Mama gave me a look, and I couldn't tell if she was impressed or just amused. It was the kind of look you give a baby who tries to do something grown, like use a typewriter. Did he hit you back? She asked. The father did. The son was just sitting there in shock. You hurt? Nah, I said. He didn't do nothing but slap me. You got off easy, Mama said. He the one got off easy, I said. Now that the landlord was gone, the neighbors came closer, clucking their tongues and looking to see what we had that they might need. They carried tight rolls of small bills that they would offer us for everything we owned in the world. Give us a minute, Mama said. Let us separate out the things we want to keep. From the grocery sack, she pulled a box of garbage bags. Just take one. Then she gave me a can of Pringles and a Coke, in case you want a snack first. We sat down together on the mattress. I opened the can of Pringles and smiled to let Mama know that I appreciated her getting me the good chips and not the off-brand snacks. She tried to smile back, but then Shelby pointed and gave out a scream like someone was trying to kill her. I followed her finger and saw a styrofoam cup, crushed and leaking black dirt. It's my bean plant, she wailed. I grew it at school. I pulled Shelby onto my lap and kissed the top of her head. Mama, I said, I didn't know it was this bad. She shrugged because she knew that I knew that she had lost her job at the Sunbeam Bread Factory. Why they let her go, I had no idea. It might have been her fault. It might have been theirs. It could be that the boss was a racist or maybe an equal opportunity asshole. It could have been anything. And right now, I guess it didn't matter. I didn't think Roscoe would actually put me out. I thought he was trying to scare me with the eviction slips. She lay back and shut her eyes like she was trying to get in a whole nap in a few seconds. I stretched myself out beside her and I beat my fist into the mattress. Why do we have to live like this? Mama opened her eyes and said, what do you want me to say? She sounded like the tiredest person in the world. This wasn't the first time this happened to us, and it wasn't the last. But somehow, it was the worst. I tucked some clothes in the black garbage bag. I knew better than to take more things than I could carry. I can't recall what I took with me, which is wild, because these must have been the things I figured I couldn't live without. I do know what I left behind. My prom dress, a tiered getup that I brought from Lerner Shops in Greenbrier Mall, across from the frozen yogurt shop where I handed out samples almost every weekend. Mama, to her credit, counseled me to keep the dress. And the landlord, to his credit, hung the dress in its plastic wrapper from a low-hanging branch on a dogwood tree. As much as I loved that dress when I was paying off the layaway, now I couldn't stand the sight of it. The optimistic pink print and the bright blue bow just seemed stupid. Just sell it, I said to Mama. We both knew good and well I wasn't going to nobody's prom now. We did sell it, along with anything else our neighbors would take off our hands. I guess it was good of them to offer to pay it all. Anything we couldn't carry, we would leave on the yard, free for the taking. Everyone came with their money browsing through our belongings like they were at a flea market. They didn't say how much, and we didn't say what we thought our stuff was worth. They gave us what they had and took whatever they wanted. It wasn't like we had a lot. We'd only been in that place 2 years, and before that, we had got put out, so we started from scratch. Travel light, my mama said. Always travel light so you can get out when you have to go. I'm with traveling light, but living light is something else. If you want something to last, it's got to be heavy. When Javante's daddy said he wanted to get married as soon as he had money saved for a ring, I told him to forget the jewelry. I wanted a house. We had a long courtship with both of us putting away our pennies for almost 3 years. We left Flipper Temple AME after saying our vows and moved into a red brick home of our own. Regardless of what happened next, I will always be proud of that. Everybody deserves to be proud of something. The house we were here to clean out wasn't that different than the one I lived in 5 or 6 blocks over. Just from the outside, you could tell that the people who had lived here were renters. There were none of the little touches that showed that they had been here for the long haul. No hanging baskets waving from the porch or welcome mat at the top of the steps. Big Pete flipped through an enormous key ring until he found the one to pop the lock, while Mauricio put the stake in the yard advertising the company. Praise the Lord that nobody was there when we got there. That's the worst, Mauricio said. When you get there and the person is there trying to keep us from taking their stuff out. He shook his head, probably remembering the elderly woman who came at him with the little fireplace shovel. I kept telling her I was just doing my job. And then she started talking about Jesus and the Romans. He shook his head. It was a lot. When we stepped over the threshold, we were hit with the thick perfume of potpourri and the dry warmth of forced air. Big Pete busied himself opening windows as me and Mauricio did a quick walkthrough. The 2 bedrooms looked like the family had just stepped out to go to the store or something. One bed was fixed up pretty with ruffled shams that matched the valance over the window. The second bed was rumpled and smelled like a boy. The living room was full of plants, healthy looking in matching bronze pots. My mama had a green thumb like that. Sometimes we lived in a house with a little yard and she could coax whatever was growing in the flower bed. She could make hydrangeas change colors by planting nails in the soil. Shelby inherited that gift. She bought orchid plants from the grocery store and could make them bloom again and again by feeding them ice cubes. Look at these, I called to Mauricio, pointing at a collection of Christmas cactuses loaded with pink flowers. They remind me of your grandmother. Nice, he said, just to be nice. The cactuses sat on top of an enormous cherrywood table with intricate carvings on the legs and a big leaf in the middle that made it where it could seat 8 people. The chairs around it were mismatched. 2 seemed to go with the table with curved arms and caned seats. 3 more were regular chairs like the ones I have in my house. And there was a folding chair like you have to go with your card table on spades night. At the head of the table was a high chair, the tray stained but clean. The table was ugly as homemade sin, but I could tell that it was expensive, or that it had been expensive at one point. When I was a girl, my grandmama had that kind of stuff in her house in Oklahoma. When she died, my mama didn't want it. All this furniture is just shit white ladies love to give their maids. I almost mentioned this to Mauricio before I changed my mind. I broke off a blooming sprig, intending to take it home to try and root it, but Big Pete knocked it out of my hand on purpose. He swept the pots into a big plastic bag. He called over his shoulder, "Stop looking and get to packing." Through the plate glass, I watched him set the potted plants on the yard. It was official. The eviction had begun. I reached in my fanny pack for my phone. My son gets on me about this little pouch, saying it makes me officially old, but I told him that it's all these birthdays adding up that have made me old. That and chasing his rusty butt around. I like this pouch, having everything I need on my hip. I also like my Bluetooth that I keep stuck in my ear, although Javante makes fun of that too. Mrs. Overeducated, who was the secretary, answered on the first ring. "Ma'am," I said, "it's a lot of stuff in this house. I don't see us getting it done in 2 hours." Mrs. Overeducated was a nice enough white lady. I never had any issues with her. None of the other girls complained either. I can't tell you how rare that is. Now her husband, that's a different issue. Mrs. Overeducated said, "It's a dispossession, right?" Just hearing that word brought back memories the way you can suddenly remember your grandmama when there's a 7-Up cake in the oven. Dispossession is the technical way to say somebody is getting put out. "Yes," I said. "So unfortunate," said Mrs. Overeducated. "My brother owns that property, so basically we had no choice. You know how it is with family. Let me see what I can do." She went away for a moment, putting on zippy violin music to keep me company while I waited. "Hello," said Mr. Overeducated. "Sir," I said, "this is Cheryl. I am over with the guys at the house on Stewart Avenue. You mean Metropolitan Parkway. I could hear the air quotes in his voice. I chuckled. Yeah, I can never get these names straight. He gave the grunt that passed for a laugh. Shit by any other name still draws flies. And this time, I didn't join him in the laughing. So what's the problem? We can't get this done in 2 hours. Yeah, you can. It's an eviction. Just get the crap out of there. I'm paying you for the job, but my sack of shit brother-in-law is not paying me, so I can't give it no more than 2 hours. I understand that, sir, but put Pete on the phone. I handed the phone over to Big Pete, who wiped the face of it with his shirt tail before pressing it to his ear. They talked another couple minutes, with Pete mostly saying, uh-huh, and yeah, and then chuckling a little, saying something about how women are. Then he gave the phone another quick wipe and handed it back to me. Just pack it up and get it out, he said. Nobody trying to provide white glove service. Just get the shit out. And then, to underscore his point, he called Mauricio over. Help me with this ugly couch. On three, they lifted it with a grunt. We made fast work of it for the most part. Everything in the refrigerator and freezer I just dumped into a big black garbage bag. There wasn't much in there, but I hesitated a second at a jar of the bright red cherries you use to make Shirley Temples. It seemed like something she was saving for a good day. The dishes I stacked in boxes with no bubble wrap or paper in between. The cast iron skillet I wrapped with her dish towels. I set it aside so when she came back to see what she was to take with her, she would be able to find it. My mama always saved her skillet no matter what happened. It belonged to her mama and her mama before. I have it now, and I used it this morning to fry up some pretend bacon that's supposed to help lower cholesterol. By the time I got to the bedroom, the fellas had pretty much moved all the furniture out. They dumped out the dresser drawers to make the hall a little easier. All her clothes, trinkets, and forget-me-nots were strewn over the floor, waiting for me to scoop it all in trash bags. Mauricio bent down to help, and I could tell his back was bothering him. I was scooping and stacking the best I could, aware that we were already an hour and a half in. We are going to be here a while, I said. Well, Big Pete says he's leaving after 2 hours. Big Pete been working here longer than me. I'm still on my probation time. I have to stay till it's done. You finish this room, said Mauricio. I'll get the bathroom. No, I said, jumping up. Let me handle the bathroom. She don't need you looking at all her private stuff. I've seen female stuff, he said. You know I live with my girl. She's 3 months pregnant. I told you that, right? I put my fingers to my lips. No, you did not tell me. Why do you think I'm trying to get all these extra hours? I looked him over like he was the one actually carrying the baby. Is your mother excited? He shrugged. Didn't tell her yet. This will be grandbaby number 4 for her. The thrill is gone. What about you? He hesitated for a quick second. I don't think excited is the word. I'm glad about it. We didn't do it on purpose. You know how you see those white people on TV setting timers and stuff trying to get pregnant? It wasn't like that. Well, I said, telling him what my mother used to tell me. If you're not trying not to get pregnant, you're trying to get pregnant. He shook his head with a little laugh. Do they teach you that in mama school? That's what my mom said. It's what her mom said. But we're grown. I'm 27, she's 23. It's good. I'm ready. To show me how ready he was, he opened the cabinet under the sink and didn't blink at the tiny box of tampons. Most everything was miniature like that. Even the condoms came in a 3-pack. Hair gel she bought by the quart. I knew we were supposed to just get the stuff out the house, but it's my nature to sort and organize, so I arranged the toilet items by user. I was just finishing the tight linen closet when Big Pete popped his head in the bathroom. I'm done, he said. My job is to move furniture, and the furniture is out. We are getting paid for 2 hours, and I put in 2.5. That last 30 minutes was a tithe. Y'all got 5 more minutes, and then I'm taking the truck on home. Aw, Pete, I said, you can pull this kind of trick because you know your job ain't going nowhere. I'm on probation. The man is looking for a reason to let me go. Mauricio piped up. You know I'm not his favorite person either. Pete shrugged. Seems like y'all got problems. He grinned at Mauricio. I sure hate it for you, son, but today is King Day. and it is my constitutional right to go home and sit my black ass on the couch. He saluted and left. Short version is this. It took us 2 more hours to gather a family's life and set it on the yard. Mauricio was a big help. He neither dillied nor dallied. He picked up what was clearly a stolen stop sign and carted it out without even remarking on how much bigger it seemed than when you just see it on the corner. He didn't wonder out loud how they got it down and why anybody would store a big stolen stop sign up under the bed. "Auntie," Mauricio said as I was checking all the closets to make sure they were empty. "Yes, baby?" For a quick second, I pretended that he was my son, hardworking and well brought up, knowing to put a handle on the names of grown people. Javante was polite like that before I sent him up to Vermont, but when he came back, he addressed adults by their Christian names like it wasn't nothing but a thing. I thought his daddy was going to stroke out that time he called Deaconship Nathaniel. I'll never forget it. It seemed like Javante went out of his way to do it, just to push his daddy to the edge. I didn't plan it or see it coming, but this time I stepped in front of Javante as the belt was coming down. The buckle curved around my raised up arm and hit me right between my eyebrows. My husband called my name, not in anger, but with regret. I turned toward my son, who had already been struck a half a dozen times. I wanted him to see what I would do for him, how much I loved him. "Javante," I said, "sweetheart." "Don't act like you love me," he said. "You can't send me away and then act like you love me." That was a hard night. And maybe it had been the end of our family. The next day, our son went back to New England. The next month, his daddy moved out. "Aunt Cheryl," Mauricio said, "what are we going to do about this table?" He was sitting on the thing with his spaghetti legs swinging. Big Pete was long gone, and I'm not a big woman. I'm not slim as I used to be, but at the same time, I am not as strong either. Even in my youth, I couldn't have handled half of that cherry wood monstrosity. I looked at Mauricio, who was in his prime, and I didn't think he was up to it either. "Fuck," he said. "Language," I said. "But yeah, fuck." The solution was to take it apart. Big Pete, with his sorry self, must have thought about this before he left because he left his toolkit by the door. "That's so trifling," I said. "At least he left it," said Mauricio. "Low bar," I said. "I'm a half-full kind of person," said Mauricio, scooching on his back to examine the underside of the table. "We are going to have to flip this heavy mother over." "On three," he said. "And lift with your legs, not with your back. You hear me, Auntie? With your legs." It took a minute, but we got the table on the floor, legs in the air like an unlucky roach. "Give me a Phillips screwdriver." I handed it to him. When I was in school thinking I would learn to be a medical professional, they actually taught us how to hand people things. I almost laughed at the idea that I was finally putting my skills to work. Hunched over his task so I couldn't see his face, he said, "Auntie Cheryl?" I lied.
"About what?"
"About being ready. I'm not ready for a kid." "Well," I said, "nobody is ready for kids. You might think you're ready, but nothing can really prepare you for it." "You know, it's not the same for everybody," he said, getting up from the floor and stretching his back, wincing. He let out a breath and stretched again, and this time it didn't seem to hurt him. "Look at me," he said. "I'm not even 30, and my back's already half broke. My girl was trying to be a nurse, you know. That's why she was in that school with you. She is still paying the bills for that. The main things is that you love each other," I said. "What did Tina Turner tell y'all about that?" He tried to say it light, like it was a joke. "You love her and she loves you. Y'all will give the baby love. That's your foundation." I know, he said. "Let me stop being such a chump. It's just that I want a sit-down job. I want to be like Javante, thinking about ice cream all day and cashing big checks on the 1st and the 15th. "That's not what you want," I said. "Not really." He fitted a bit onto a drill. "Why not? Everybody loves money and ice cream." As he disassembled the table, I nursed my memories on the back of my tongue like a bitter lozenge. When the recruiters came to convince us to send our son to Vermont, They asked about Mauricio. They said that studies had shown that inner-city kids do better up there if they have someone they can relate to. I considered it for a moment as my husband pressed his lips tight and shook his head. What's the point of getting him out of the hood if we send the hood up there with him? We fought about it that night. My husband said, "Look, I call it like I see it. My nephew is a good kid, too. He's going to be in jail by the time he's 21. You know it, I know it. The question is whether you want our son to be locked up there with him." We got the table apart and stacked the legs like firewood. "I told you Javonte was supposed to be here this weekend?" "I know," Mauricio said. "He had to work or something." "That's what he told me." "You don't believe him, do you?" I shook my head and sat on the scratchy carpet. "He doesn't like it here. He says he doesn't know anyone anymore." "I don't have a problem with Javonte," Mauricio said. "We just don't keep in touch. We're dudes. Brothers don't hang on the phone like girls," he tried to laugh. "You two were so close before he left. We were kids back then. Hell, we were sharing a room. You can't help but be close when you're living in a room together, smelling each other's dirty drawers. After that, I went back to my mama and he went to Vermont. You know how it went down." "Did you have a fight?" Mauricio hesitated, just a quick blank space like when a record skips. I had a choice then. I could push it, or I could let it go. "What happened?" "It's not a big deal, Aunt Cheryl. Just some kid shit. You don't need to hear about it." "Tell me," I said. "For real," he said. "It's nothing." "It's something," I said. "Now tell me." Mauricio threw up his hands. Okay, it's not a big deal, I swear. When he came home, he was different. He talked funny, he dressed funny. Everything about him was funny, so I was messing with him. You know, saying he was acting white. Telling him we were going to start calling him Carlton. You know, stuff like that. He got really mad and then he said something about my mama." "No," I said, "that's not how it happened. Javonte loves Shelby." "Let me take that back," Mauricio said. "He didn't say anything about her, per se. He said something that had to do with her." "Just spit it out, boy," I said. Mauricio took a deep breath. "He said, at least I'm not gonna end up like you working at the same Burger King as your mama." I gave a little whimper, and Mauricio joined me on the carpet. "Aunt Cheryl, it wasn't all that bad. I bet the way I told it made it seem worse than it was. It was my fault. I shouldn't have been riding him like that. But," I said, "I know." "Oh, Auntie," Mauricio said, "don't start crying. I never know what to do when people start crying." "Now me and you are working the same job," I said. There really wasn't anything to say after that. Mauricio didn't talk while he finished taking apart the table that reminded me of everything my mother didn't want. I opened my mouth to tell him something about how hard work is nothing to be ashamed of, but I remembered that summer that he and Shelby were both working in that fast food restaurant. Mauricio working there didn't bother me much. He was a kid, and it was a kid job. I hated seeing Shelby, 30-year-old mother of four, dropping fries and pulling milkshakes. Not my Shelby, who had been such a smart little kid who used to tell anyone who would listen that she was going to be a scientist when she grew up. She protested that she was an assistant manager, but I wasn't impressed. I tried to remember if I had said anything to Javonte about it. I wondered if I had let something slip. "I love you," I said to the man in the room and the boys that I remembered. "I know you do, Auntie." "I love everybody," I said. "I love you, your mama, Javonte. I even love my ex. I don't have any shortage of loving." "Please don't cry, Auntie. It's all good. We are working, right? You know what's worse than a shitty job? No job." And with that, he started carrying out the pieces of the ornate table. I walked out behind him and watched as he set the carved wood legs down on top of the mattress, gently, as though he didn't want to upset them. I walked through the rooms again, making sure everything was cleared out. Every space was empty. After I closed up, I fastened the deadbolt on the wrought iron burglar door, right under the notice from the sheriff's office. It was almost 4 o'clock. In wintertime, that's pretty much evening. The neighbors emerged from the houses, watching from their steps. They are waiting for us to go before they start going through the stuff, Mauricio said. How many hours have we been here? 5 and a half? Mauricio yanked up the company sign. Let's start walking before it gets dark. A little boy approached us on a beat-up bike. He was narrow like Mauricio, but short like Javante. You the one that's overeducated? He asked, looking at the sign. Mauricio laughed. Nope, I barely finished high school. You don't want to be like me. You overeducated? He turned to me. Put a handle on that, said Mauricio. The youngster said, you overeducated, ma'am? It was true that I hadn't spent enough time in classrooms to call myself educated, let alone overeducated. But I knew things. My mind is full of things that I wish I had known when I was a younger woman, when there was still time to make a better choice. When you find things out after the fact, it's not like you just stumble on the understanding, like finding a coupon in the bottom of your purse just to see that it's expired. Everything you know in the world, you learn it hard, even if you discover it too late to use it. Go home to your mama, I told him. He pouted, dissatisfied with my answer. Go home to your mama, I said to him again, a little louder. Gone home. The street light's not even on, he countered. Still, I said. Gone home. She's worried about you.
This has been an Audible Original. Produced by Audible Originals. Written by Tayari Jones. Performed by Gabrielle Union. Executive producers, Andrew Eisenman and Chris Sacco. Directed by Chris Sacco. Edited by Nikki Banks Maurer. Mastered by Joseph Delaquilla. Acquisition and development, Rena Ayer. Vice President of Audible Studios, Mike Charzik. Editor-in-Chief, Audible Original Publishing, David Blum. Copyright 2020 by Tayari Jones. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.